This Week in Retronauts, welcome back to a place where flowers are still only one guild. Everyone, welcome to a follow-up episode of Retronauts. I am Jeremy King Jackass Parrish, and this week we are going to finish up the Final Fantasy VII episode that we started a few weeks back and did not finish. Much like Tetsuya Nomura, we just can't bring it home. But today we're going to try to do the impossible, and we're going to try to wrap this thing. So with me here once again, in a small and crowded room is...
Hey, it's Bob Mackey. My favorite part of this game is the CPR minigame. Mm-hmm. So much fun. I can't wait for that in the remake.
Materia Thief, Cat Bailey.
And, what? Snowboarder extraordinaire.
Undead Detective, Chris Kohler.
I mean, it's good to snowboard. Everyone grieves in their own way.
Right. Robot cat riding a Moogle suit.
Yes. All right. Chris so Kohler. A few episodes back, we talked about Final Fantasy VII, and we got as far as the end of Disc 1. That's not very far. There's three discs, so there's still a lot of the game for us left to discuss. We also didn't talk about things like the characters and the some of the localization changes and the sequels and spinoffs.
Did
and
we get to the end
the
of
Legacy.
Disc 1 or the end of Midgar?
End of Midgar.
End of Midgar.
Isn't that the end of Disc 1?
It's disc not.
1 is...
Oh, no?
I think, Aerith
right,
gets killed and then
that's right.
It's the end of
Oh, my God, you spoiled it. Jesus.
Oh, my God. I'm
sorry.
So sorry.
It's been a long time since I've actually played this all the way through. I'm going off memories here. So I may be totally wrong about everything. Okay, so we got to the end of Midgar, which is, in our hearts is the end of Disc 1. But in terms
sure
of the
feels like the end of Disc 1,
it does.
It?
Like in a future episode of future Final Fantasy VII for PlayStation 2, PlayStation 1, that would have been like, please insert Disc 2. But I guess not. So my mistake, I'm already screwing up here. So
sorry.
It's terrible. But anyway... folks, we need to talk some more about Final Fantasy VII, and we got to make it snappy. So let's bring this thing home. So it occurs to me that we did not really talk about the characters last time, and they're kind of, I feel like they're one of the big selling points of the game. Like, you know, as much as Square and Sony push this game on the graphical appeal, what people really respond to most of all with Final Fantasy VII is the characters, at least as much as any other, I think, entry in the series. And, you know, the characters in this game are very different from any characters who had been in Final Fantasy VII before, like as the main cast. And there are a few reasons for that, one of which is that this was the first game whose characters were not designed or illustrated really by Yoshitaka Amano, who we've talked about before, was a, you know, like a very talented artist, kind of dabbled in both fine art and also doing character design for things like Gatchaman. And, you know, he brought this sort of ethereal painterly quality to the designs of the previous games. And then, you know, sprite artists would come in and be like, okay, we can't do that with like 16 pixel high characters. So let's kind of interpret that however we can. But for PlayStation, things worked differently. And I think Amano had – I think we talked about last time he had like some sort of commitment, like he was doing a show or something that tied him up, and he was not able to do the his usual work. And so Tetsuya Nomura stepped in, who had been previously with the series in some other capacities. And I feel like his design approach – worked out a lot better for the PlayStation 1 because you went from, you know, hand-drawn sprites to 3D polygons, but very, very limited polygons. I mean, now you have characters like their faces are 150 polygons or 1.5 million or whatever it is, 150,000 I meant. But, you know, back on PlayStation 1, your characters were basically made out of simple triangles. And as it happens, Nomura was very, I feel, heavily influenced by sort of – Akira Toriyama's artwork. Mm. His characters have that sort of like angular, sort of spiky, sort of kind of common shared faces between them. And those translated really well to polygons. So I don't know. What do you guys think about the character designs and the characters in general in Final Fantasy VII?
I agree with what you're saying, Jeremy. I think they were developed with the technology in mind and the limitations. And I think they're all developed around – each character has like certain qualities that are can be made very distinct even if the character is abstracted to like a very simple level as you would see in, you know – the world map and things like that. So I feel like these characters, even though they have a, like they have crap hanging off of them, like an Image Comics character, they all have very distinct qualities that make them identifiable.
I mean, it's really like if you want to talk about them having, you know, excessively baroque character designs, I really feel like these characters much more simplified compared to Amano's character design.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, but I feel like Nomura would get more, his designs would get like more baroque over time sure. But
Now that we're on PlayStation 2, everyone can have belts.
Yeah.
So many belts.
But with Cloud, it's just like his hair is so his hair is ridiculous and it's very anime, but it's also so it's like, okay, I can see him. I can see always see Cloud on the map.
Like,
I can always see where he is.
There's a yellow spiky mass there. That's with blue underneath.
And he'll usually be the character you're controlling on any screen. So I feel like, yeah, that was like a game designer designing a character instead of an artist.
Mm-hmm. I liked his hair so much. I thought it was so cool back at the time. And back then, I was still drawing, and so every character from that point, every male character from that point, I basically tried to draw with that hairstyle. It was my first real exposure to anime hair in the 90s. It was amazing. And of course, the big sword, the big Buster sword, both of these were iconic qualities. Cloud, a sword and a hairstyle. That's all he really needed, right? But it drew the eye. Mm-hmm. It stood out from the characters that were around at that time. And if you look at the entire cast, they were pretty distinct, especially for that time period. You had characters like Cid, who was cursing, and he was kind of embittered, and he wasn't the kind of guy that you would see in a Super Nintendo or a 16-bit RPG.
Yeah, he's kind of actually horrible.
Like, yeah.
He's really awful to his partner. Like, he's an abusive, not spouse, I guess, but he's, like, super horrible to the woman he lives with, and it's a little hard to stomach these days, but I guess that was definitely not something you expected in a protagonist in a video game back then.
If it was the PlayStation's kind of with Nintendo was still being Nintendo, especially with the Nintendo 64, and it fit very much with the PlayStation's ethos of, we're grown up, we're the adult console, and look at these characters, and these characters are our headliners. Look how adult they are. And I guess for adult, it's adult that would appeal to teenagers. So
yeah, Cid was a haggard old man of 32. I had to look that up. I was like, he had to be at least 34, right? No, 32.
Life is rough in Rocket Town.
I guess so.
I mean, you smoke that much. I mean,
he should have vaped instead.
Unless you want to sponsor our podcast.
So, you make a really good point. Like, all the characters follow that sort of cardinal rule that everyone has to look distinct. And, each one has their own color scheme. I feel like Cid is kind of the least distinct. He doesn't really stand out to me in terms of design.
He was smoking.
But a cigarette is like 2 pixels. Eris is pink with brown hair. Mm. And then Tifa is like black and white. And Barret is very large and very black. Catchy is very large and very white. So, they definitely stand apart. Like, there's a lot of contrast with all the characters. And then Red 13, of course, is a bright red cat. He's like Marmaduke as a feline.
Yuffie is green,
that's right.
And I think the sprite artist would change Amano's art pretty drastically, mm-hmm. just because I think in 5, isn't it 5 where it's like all the characters have white hair in his original designs?
That's most of – he always gives them white hair or blonde hair.
But I think by 6, they were like, okay, here's the colors we want on the screen, and all the 6 characters have the correct hair that is identifiable in the sprites. With older games, it seemed like, okay, everybody needs different hair colors just so you can know what's going on.
Yeah, you would get occasional characters like Rydia who have green hair, but otherwise it was like, yeah, blonde.
And in a game like Final Fantasy VII, where all the characters are basically blobs and you have no fine details at all, it helps to have really broad details that stand out, like color schemes or hair.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean,
and it just would have been a lot more difficult to get character designs back from Amano and then say, okay, well, how do we convert this into something that works in polygons? It would have been a really heavy lift, and they would have just they just wouldn't have looked very similar at all.
Yeah, these character designs were actually, I remember, pretty controversial when they were among Final Fantasy fans when the game first came out. I mean, this whole game was very controversial.
All 12 of them.
Among Final Fantasy fans. No, like, I hung out on some RPG-centered forums, and there were definitely people who were like, this doesn't have the Final Fantasy feel. Mm-hmm. These character designs are weird. And some of them, I feel like, I do kind of look at them and I feel like, well, maybe this is a little too simple. Like, Tifa is just like wearing a white tube top and a mini skirt. And then like her details are she has suspenders for some reason, I guess to keep her mini skirt from falling down, like fighting gloves and combat boots. And that's pretty much – that's Tifa. Yeah. Well, then she's got like a weird split ponytail, a very long ponytail. But yeah, there's not a lot of detail to her. But then on the other hand, Barret is fairly detailed. He's got like a vest over a shirt and there's a lot of sort of minor details on the vest. And then he's got a machine gun for an arm, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Which is he's a guy with a machine gun for an arm. Like that's – it definitely makes him stand out.
It can be other things. You can put a, like an axe on there too.
That's true. Like or a mace. I think you can. Yeah. Like you can use it as a flail occasionally, mm-hmm. but it works best as a machine gun. Some of the characters have maybe a little too much detail and a little too little detail. Kind of even them out a little bit. But I like the original designs better than the everyone is wearing black leather remakes that they got in Advent Children where everyone is like very solemn, sad, mm. and like they saved the world. They don't have to be gloomy. But no, they're all wearing mournful funeral black. I don't know.
Yeah, just look at the difference between Cloud and Smash Brothers. You can either play him as original Cloud or you can play him with long black trench coat Cloud.
So yeah, the characters themselves have very elaborate backstories. Some of them, I mean, Sid, yeah, he was like a guy who wanted to be an astronaut, and then they pulled out the funding from the space program. So he lived
his life.
Thanks,
Nixon.
Right, he lived his life in bitterness and resentment. So that's understandable. Red 13 was like the last surviving member of a race of talking cats.
I learned something really horrible today. Mm. Apparently, Hojo wanted to mate Aerith and Red 13.
He was a weirdo. Barret became a rebel because like bad stuff happened in his hometown, and eventually you go back and find the hometown, and you find the guy who started Avalanche, and they've kind of had a falling out. And then Ketchi, I feel, is like needlessly baroque. He is a robot cat riding a stuffed Moogle who is actually like the in-party avatar for an agent of Shinra who is spying on the good guys. It's a very convoluted way to go about that task. Like, I know, I'm going to create this very strange stuffed animal who just like tags along with my enemies and they're of course going to just invite him into the party and let him fight along.
Yep.
It was kind of a weird gambit, but I guess it worked out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's driven by a guy named Reeve who works for Shinra, and Reeve is what the definition of somebody who thinks that he can change the organization, the evil organization from within. That's my impression of Reeve. I don't remember him super well, but he's kind of the good guy. Eventually it comes out that he's the good guy Shinra executive. Mm.
And then does anyone want to try to explain Cloud's background? Anyone?
He was originally a normal soldier who idolized Sephiroth.
Not a soldier.
A regular, like an actual.
Army, like, yeah, soldier, lowercase, all lowercase letters as opposed
army
to all
guy.
Capitals.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
And they go on a mission. Sephiroth goes crazy. Cloud manages to run him through. Sephiroth falls into the life stream. And then Cloud gets taken and put into – experimented upon for the next 5 years or so by Hojo, but eventually broken out by Zack. And then Zack dies and Cloud kind of takes on his identity.
Very good.
Zack is an actual soldier, all caps, who was like best buds with Sephiroth for a while and also Gackt. And we'll talk about that some other time.
Zack is gacked, right?
Oh, no, no, Zack is not gacked.
The gacked is a third guy.
I think he's, is he Genesis or is he Angeal?
Hmm.
This is Do you guys remember
Core.
Crisis Core?
I just knew it was Cloud, Zack, and other guy.
You don't remember your expanded universe
no.
canon? Okay. Yeah, there were like...
Well, Disney just absolved that, so
okay.
It's gone now.
All right. Good job, Disney. Thank you for Kingdom Hearts. The whole thing with Cloud is a very convoluted backstory, and Tifa turns out to be kind of an important character because she knew Cloud before he was a soldier or a soldier, and so when he starts giving his backstory, she's kind of like... is that right? I remember it differently. And that turns out to be really significant once you realize that, oh, yeah, Cloud just has a lot of fake memories that have been implanted in his brain. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of messed up.
We talk about that in the first episode where, like, they're having their moment very early on where they're like, we were childhood friends. Were we? Okay.
Well, I think they were childhood friends.
They were.
It was just like everything that happened kind of between childhood friends and
there's kind of some disagreement
meeting up
on
in
that.
Bar, Texas. Yeah. Oh, go on. Do tell.
Well, it's more like Cloud kind of had a crush on her from afar, but they didn't really know each other all that well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, she was the hot girl who had the cowboy hat, so kind of out of his league. He was just a dork who wanted to join the army and couldn't even make the elite ranks. Mm-hmm. So really – and then, of course, there are the optional characters, Yuffie Kisaragi and Vincent Valentine. And in terms of backstory complexity, they're kind of at opposite ends of the scale. Yuffie's just like a kid in a town full of ninja. And she's like, it'd be cool to steal everyone's materia. And then she joins your party when you realize, oh, we need someone to like use the mug materia we have. And then Vincent Valentine... Boy.
He's like every Universal movie monster.
Yeah.
And a guy. And also Bash the Stampede.
Almost Sephiroth's dad or something.
Hmm. There's Hojo. But there was some debate over that as well. But it was eventually like established in the one of the source material guides by word of God that no, it was actually Hojo who was Sephiroth's father.
Okay. Right. But he had a thing for Lucretia.
Yes.
Wasn't that her name?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who was the like... Basically, the surrogate mother, like the in vitro mother for Sephiroth.
My understanding is that Lucretia was pregnant with Sephiroth and Hojo secretly injected Genova cells into her to make him into a super soldier.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. As one does.
Yep.
I read up on all of this before coming here so that I could like get all of the details right.
Well, nice. Thank you for doing that because...
It's very confusing still.
Mm. Yeah, this game has a really convoluted story, and it was not made any more approachable in the U.S. by the extremely variable quality localization. Some parts of the localization are actually pretty good, and then other parts you're like, this isn't actually how any human has ever spoken ever. It's not – this is not grammar.
In 1997, it was a feature rather than a bug. It's like, I mean, this is extremely complicated and confusing, but that must mean that it's really good.
I don't know. Even at the time, like I remember – certainly I was part of a cool clique of people online who were like, what's wrong with this? Like the writing in this is really bad compared to 6. Like I understand what happened in 6, but here like – it's a complicated plot, but also a lot of the writing just isn't coherent. Like, what's going on? Like, it's badly translated.
I think it wouldn't be a year, if I remember correctly, that Square would – like, a year from after this game came out, that's when Square would take localization more seriously, have, like, a method, have a department. Just the people working on these games are like –
The difference between 7 and 8 is just ridiculous.
But the people working on these games are like, we need to have more organization here because of what happened.
By the time they were translating 8, I think the translators were – working in the office in Japan had access to people. And also, I mean, it was sort of happening more simultaneously. It's not like 8 came out in Japan and then after they were done with 8, it's like, okay, let's start on the English. That's 8, I think, is when they started doing it at the same time because I don't think there was that much of a delay.
There was a pretty decent delay.
Was there?
8, I want to say, came out...
99.
Yeah, it was 99, but I feel like
March,
it was early, early in the year, like spring.
Yeah.
And then it came out in the U.S. on Dreamcast Day.
It did.
So
it did.
That was September. Yes. So that's half a year.
It was September 8th, I remember.
This is a very tall order.
I picked it up the same, like the release was the same day as Dreamcast.
No, I went 2 days in a row to get Final Fantasy VIII, and then I went back to get Dreamcast.
Your store lied.
I got mine on 9/2/99.
What?
But yeah, way early. But
wow, that is really early.
It would be a tall order, but I really want someone to do it like a Legend of a localization style thing for Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah.
Just even with simple games like Legend of Zelda and Super Mario Brothers 1, you see how much you miss and mm-hmm. a lot of intentionality you miss. And I'm wondering just like how much stuff is buried in the original text that we never even talk about.
I feel like with 7, it was just like one person on a super tight. It was like Ted Wolsey doing Secret of Mana again, where it was like one person on a super ridiculous, makes no sense deadline who just had to do it.
Tim Rogers was, at last I checked, doing an extremely exhaustive look at the Japanese version of Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, he's done. Okay. Yeah, he compared the two, actually, and went through the whole game. It's like 20 hours of
sure was. I was watching
fascinating video.
And so it was a solid 10 minutes of him like going back and forth on a text message chain with the guys who exactly.
So this actually exists, the thing I want.
Yeah, no, okay. Yeah. It's on YouTube.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I should know about this. Damn.
So we've talked about the protagonists, the playable party, and we talked a bit last time about the materia system and how it kind of takes away the idea of job classes and basically says anyone can be anything you want. Mm-hmm. But there is still some element of distinction between the characters just in terms of the weapons they use. Like some characters are always going to be short-range fighters and some characters are going to be long-range fighters, and then there's a few that are – They can switch, I think. Barrett, you mentioned you can put different things, like replace his gun arm with like just other weapons. And I think that determines whether he's a ranged fighter or a short range fighter.
It does, yeah.
And I think Red 13 is like medium range or something. He uses like his weapons are barrettes on his hair locks that it's kind of a strange idea. But
then there's also long range materia, which you can slap
that's
on
true.
Somebody.
Yep.
So anyone can be an archer, basically, but with a sword.
And I love about materia that the materia levels up. I mean, that's just fun because then you look at that and you're like, oh, I'm going to get, you know, some extra ability once I level up, or it's, you know, something good's going to happen. But it doesn't matter who I put it on. Mm-hmm. Like I can just stick this on somebody and level it up, and it's good because you don't feel like you're going to make the wrong decision. But, you know, because if they did it where you put the materia on somebody and then they learned that skill, you might feel like you had wasted it or something.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Final Fantasy IX did that, and I think that system works really well. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, they looked at the Magicite from Final Fantasy VI, and we're like, well, yeah, that Magicite piece is leveling up and will eventually like do interesting things, but also confer abilities onto the characters. Mm-hmm. And we're like, well, what if we took away the conferring thing,
right?
Like, and we didn't really give any characters permanent stat changes except like health and defense and that sort of thing, And then you can just mix and match your party and do whatever you want with anyone.
And you can also, I mean, it provides a limitation because it's like, okay, well, you're only gonna have one Knights of the Round materia. Mm-hmm. You get one. So, I mean, you can't just grind it out so that every one of your characters can always use this.
Right. Although, once you have seen Knights of the Round in action, you're like, well, I don't ever want to have to sit through that again.
Yep.
So, no,
and then
you
fight Ruby Weapon and Emerald Weapon, and you get to see Knights in the Round like 10 times in a row.
Good times.
Yeah.
So it is interesting. Like you mentioned that you can't just, you know, grind out and give everyone these abilities. But one of the things about mastering materia is that once a materia is mastered, it does often spawn like the lower level ones, the standard ones.
Right.
Maybe not the summons, but like spells will spawn a new materia. So then you can like build up another, you know, like fire materia or whatever.
Yep.
So it does kind of open up these opportunities for you. And it really does. It really, I think, appeals to the min-max type character or players in a way that Final Fantasy V did. But despite the fact that it does not have a job system or anything like it, it still gives you that like, oh, I got to keep grinding for experience because I got to get my AP, gotta build up my master materia. Mm. So yes, it's a very addicting system, addicting. Yes, that.
I feel like what really makes a lot of the characters stand out is the way that their ultimates work or their limit breaks end up working. I mean, if you look at Cloud, Omni Slash, probably one of the most powerful abilities in the entire game, able to do quadruple nine damage like several times. Or you have a character like Tifa with her slot machine and all of that stuff. And to me, that was ultimately like, which limit break do I want to have on this run?
Yeah, and the limit breaks do kind of speak to the concept of classes. Like Clouds, you know, that his abilities have kind of become like samurai skills in later games. Tifa's ability, like her slot machine is like – wait, she said she had slots?
Yeah,
it's like a slot machine.
What was Cat's cheese?
Like it's kind of just random, I think. Huh, I mean, it can win the battle instantly, but it's very rare.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So
it's not a great limit break.
Kind of like a hint of class there, but not necessarily. So it really does kind of get away from that.
And it was fun to level them up and get steadily stronger limit breaks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like one thing I really like about the limit break system is that you can hang on to a limit break charge for as long as you want, as opposed to like Final Fantasy IX, where as soon as you hit that limit break, you use it. Like you don't have a choice. Your just character fires it off. So you can be fighting like, you know, level one goblins. You just happen to go over the edge. And so you use, you know, some crazy powerful attack against enemies that'll die in one hit anyway.
It's called trance.
Or an eight.
Oh, sorry, trance. Okay, my bad.
Or an eight where you would go down to one hit point and then basically you would get a limit break every turn, which was an interesting risk-reward kind of thing. But yeah, so.
Yeah, I tried to So in the PlayStation 4 version, which is the version of Final Fantasy VII that I'm currently playing, you can basically just turn on infinite limit breaks if you want. And so I was, you know, I'm not really doing this except for the fact that like I'll do it if I'm like – you can like regenerate your health and magic and get a limit break whenever you want. And I'm just kind of like, okay, well, I have no interest in dying and trying things again and playing through Final Fantasy VII again. So I'll do that if I'm like about to die and just restore myself. But after pretty soon after Midgar, you have to cross a swamp to get into some caves, and it's like, oh, there's this big serpent in there.
Yeah, Zolom.
Yeah, and it's like, well, you can't get past that guy unless you're on a chocobo. And I'm like, I'm going to go try to kill him and cheat. And so I decided to go in there, and I just turn on infinite limit breaks. I'm just limit breaking this guy over and over and over and over and over again. But unfortunately – well, fortunately for the game, unfortunately for me, there is just a point in that battle where he just uses a super killing death move on on everybody, and there's nothing you can do.
Okay.
Like, oops.
That's interesting because I'm glad that they accounted for that.
Yeah.
Because that is, you know, kind of like a key story point.
It is.
You know, you want to go to the next continent, but you can't because you have to cross that swamp.
Yeah.
So you can't keep chasing Sephiroth.
Yeah.
And so you have to get the Chocobo and you move along. And then later you come back and you find the Midgar Zolom is like impaled on Sephiroth's sword or something, or like not a sword, but it's just like he's killed it and impaled it on a spike or something. You're like, oh, we couldn't kill that guy,
right?
But he just
Sephiroth just did it in like the most badass way possible.
He just left its corpse behind for us to look at.
Yep.
So it really, you know, the way they build up Sephiroth throughout the game, like where you don't encounter him, but you see him like in flashbacks, and you keep like seeing the carnage he leaves behind, really does a lot to build him up as a villain. And, you know, I think the way they kind of handle him in the latter portion of the game deflates that a little bit. And that's just a danger of fiction. Like if you build up a super badass villain, you kind of have to follow through on it. And it's hard to do that. It's hard to, you know, to kind of like pay off the hint you drop in a satisfying way. But certainly, like, I can understand why he has such a place of reverence among so many people who played this game and were like, wow, he is crazy. I can't wait to fight him. He's badass.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's a shark from Jaws, right? I mean, the less you see, the more impactful the
character are. Or the Cloverfield monster.
But then there are a bunch of him at one point.
Yeah. Right. But, I mean, back in 1997, he had that really long silver hair, which looked super cool and was not cliche at all at the time, at least. I mean, not to me. I mean, and he had that.
Well, I had played Castlevania Symphony of the Night first, thanks to my desire to import the game, and therefore I was like, this is just an Alucard knockoff.
And he had that gigantic sword, that gigantic katana-looking sword, and I mean, in the long black trench coat into a certain set of teenagers, that was like, I want to look like that. Oh, my God. So
to another set of teenagers, they were like, that is hot. I'm in love with that.
And, you know, he does – whenever he did show up, he was doing something cool. I mean, in the flashback, he's using – the level 3 spells for the first time, and you're like, oh my god, look at Fire 3, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and the first time you actually encounter him in the flesh, although not actually in the flesh, which, yeah, that's a whole other thing. But the first time the party meets up with him, it's when he appears out of nowhere and kills Eris, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You don't actually meet him in person or his avatar in person until that point. So, yeah, there's all this buildup, and then all of a sudden you do meet him. And, yeah, one of your party members is permanently dead forever. Mm-hmm. So
he had one of the best
themes. That's a good job of getting that across.
He had one of the best themes, and he had one of the most—
He walked through the flames.
And he has one of the most iconic moments where he, like, glares at you and then walks, like, out of the through the flames. And, I mean— In a game that is partly defined by its CG cutscenes, that is one of the most iconic.
Mm-hmm.
And because most people in America didn't play 5 before, this sort of broke the rules as to, you know, killing characters. Like, everyone died in 4, but then, like, Love brought them back. And Shadow kind of almost died in 6. You can get him back. But in this game, it's just like, this character is not coming back.
Right.
She won't be replaced by anyone immediately. There will not be, like, a resurrection quest.
Oh, it but really everybody wanted to try and bring her back.
Of course, of course. I know all the rumors and the secrets and, you know.
It was the Shang Long of the 32-bit era.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things, the sort of slipshod localization on it left all these kind of weird openings where people were like, well, maybe I need to make use of this somehow, because it's a very convoluted story and there's weird stuff happening. And then some of the localization to English makes those things even more opaque and mysterious. And so people were like, well, you know, you meet this guy with a number in the wall market, and if you go talk to him, he's actually like a general who used to be in the army, and he can somehow resurrect Eris. And there were all these just bizarre rumors. That was a huge part of the culture around Final Fantasy VII at the time for years, until I think finally Square just came out and said, like, no, like, the whole point of the story is that she is dead. Mm-hmm. Like, the story would not have the impact it does. It would not have the meaning that it does if you could just bring her back. Like, you have to deal with the fact that, you know, she's gone. And that came from, you know, a place in Hironobu Sakaguchi's life. He, you know, kind of used the story here a little bit as therapy to work through feelings about his mother having passed away, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so.
They kind of stink so that then they would put her in everything else. Like, oh, she's in Final Fantasy Tactics and Kingdom Hearts and all these things. Like,
I mean,
she didn't really go away.
She was very popular.
She's there in our hearts. But, but you know, it's not like her appearance in Final Fantasy Tactics is like, oh, she came back to life. It's just a fun little nod. And it's not like, I don't know, is she like a spirit or something you can summon in Smash Brothers? Probably. But
she's got to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, yeah, her appearance in Kingdom Hearts where she's a kid, right? She's like a kid character, a kid version.
Oh, yeah.
No,
they're all like,
no, actually.
No, she's an adult.
Yeah, that's right. Yuffie and Selby are the kids. Right. Okay. But I mean, Kingdom Hearts, what the hell even is that? Like, yeah. I don't think anyone's like,
it's not
she
canon.
Came back to life.
We'll find out soon.
But yeah, the whole point of the game is that Eris died. And that is a big sore spot with some people. Speaking of Eris, Kat, I think you wanted to talk about the love triangle.
Well, I feel like it's one of those defining things about Final Fantasy VII's culture was, are you team Tifa, or are you team Eris, or are you team Barrett? Because people
What if you're Team Yuffie?
Shipping culture was definitely becoming a thing circa 1997, and this is one of the early examples of this in video games. And, I mean, it's defined by the fact that Cloud can choose which girl he's going to go out with and
– sort of.
And the Golden Saucer. I mean, it's defined by the decisions you ultimately
make. Right,
yeah,
it's not an overt choice. Like, you don't realize what's happening necessarily. It's not like they say, hey, do you want to go out with Tifa or Eris? It's more like – the consequences of the actions that the dialogue choices you make and the actions you take, that determines it. And then people start to compare notes, I think, and are like, oh, wait a minute. I had a date with Tifa, not Eris. What's going on?
Which characters did you guys go out with, or did you care?
I mean, playing the game originally, I wasn't aware that your actions had an effect on the date until I read about it later, but I would usually get Tifa because I liked her a lot more than Aerith.
Me too. Yeah.
The first time I played, I ended up with Eris because I thought, like, that's, you know, how the story was supposed to go. And it didn't occur to me that I should be mean to her. That's just not my personality. So, yeah, I ended up with Eris. And then I found out you could, you know, have a different date. So then I was like, well, I'm going to figure out how to go out with Yuffie because she's like the spunky, weird ninja. That's cool.
I'm Team Yuffie, so, yeah.
I forget. Probably Eris.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, and then, of course, you could go out with Barrett, and I always tried so hard to get that one, but I guess I never followed the instructions perfectly. It's like a chemistry recipe or something.
This is like Japanese strategy guide bait, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it's more of a joke date. I've seen a YouTube video of it, and, like, there's not any chemistry between Cloud and Barrett. It's like they're both very awkward and like, so what's going on? But it is in there in the game if you really just like – it's like finding the Zodiac Spear in Final Fantasy XII. You just have to know exactly what to do well in advance.
Or the Excalibur 2.
Something like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah, in Final Fantasy IX where you have to do everything perfectly for 9 hours. Yes.
Ridiculous.
Yep. So, yeah, strategy guide bait is a good way to describe it. But but yeah, you kind of get to the point of like there is a lot here that you would see explored further in later Final Fantasy games. Like this really does feel like, you know, we talked about how Final Fantasy VI is kind of like a blending of old and new, but this is where they really just started throwing all kinds of stuff against the walls. And so you have the Golden Saucer and you have all the mini games. There's so many mini games in this game.
There's so many. Like not just in the Golden Saucer, but like that was one of the things that I came away from the next 5 or so hours after Midgar that I played with is that there are so many freaking mini games in this game. And it's like, why are there so many mini games? Like, you had to go, it's like, this girl washed up on the shore and I got to give her CPR. Okay, immediately after the CPR, it's like, okay, now you got to play the mini game where you get on a dolphin and the dolphin throws you up onto the top of this tower.
And then you have to do like the salutes and stuff.
Yep, the salutes and stuff and the marching in the parade formation. And then you got to do this other thing. And it's just mini game after mini game after
mini game.
And it's like, what?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is almost all the mini games you play appear diegetically within the adventure.
Yes.
And then somehow they become things you can do at the Gold Saucer later. So if you're like, I really loved that part where Eris died and I snowboarded immediately after to work through my sorrow. So I'm just going to go do that. And I'm going to go snowboard at the Golden Saucer and remember how sad I felt about Eris over and over again.
But I loved the snowboarding, actually. That was my favorite mini game.
Lots of fun.
So I was kind of wondering, I was thinking about this, like, why would they fill this? Because it's kind of annoying because I like the downtime between dungeons, but I mean, I kind of want to, I don't necessarily want to just be playing mini games constantly during that downtime part.
I'm wondering, sorry, Chris.
Well, I kind of think that, so with the PlayStation, with polygonal characters, you didn't have to draw a new sprite and save it into memory if you wanted to make the player do something different. You could arbitrarily to sort of rig the characters to do whatever you wanted. And so I think that gave the designers a little bit of freedom so that they could say like, oh, I made this mini game where Cloud marches in place and salutes and twirls his gun and does this and does that, and did a CPR mini game where the character is, you know, on the beach, you know, restarting somebody's heart, pumping his hands up and down because it was possible to program that stuff in without having to draw literally like five more frames of animation for Cloud in which he gives somebody CPR. You could just go in and just sort of rig the character model to do it and see how it looked. So I'm thinking maybe that's why we see a lot of these things, because suddenly he can snowboard. He can do CPR. He can jump on a dolphin. He can do this and that.
I was going to say, I'm also wondering, I totally agree with Chris's idea, but I also wonder if the more involved mini games like the snowboarding and the RTS and the submarine, if those are all like internal prototypes for game ideas.
Maybe.
And they just were like, we could just put this in this unfinished state.
I just finished collecting all of the Square games that they released in Japan on the PlayStation 1, and it's just funny to, and I put them all in chronological order, and it's really interesting to look at it because like they got on the PS1 and they were just like, okay, fighting game, Mahjong game, baseball game, Bushido Blade, Final Fantasy VII, and there's a couple driving, and it's like they within the first year basically they had done so many different games and so many different genres. I think they looked at the PlayStation as this opportunity to sort of expand into new genres and things like that. So yeah possibly.
And a few things. Mm-hmm. One is I think this is a Sakaguchi thing because Nomura kind of hinted that when I talked to him about Kingdom Hearts 3 a while ago, he said that Final Fantasy should be an everything kind of game. And he kind of learned that from Sakaguchi. And so he kind of applied that to Kingdom Hearts as well. And that's why you have things like the gummy ship with the shooters.
Yeah.
Another thing is it really...
I'd rather play the CPR game for 5 hours.
Yeah.
It was a kitchen sink game. Like, they were throwing everything they possibly could into this because it was new graphics, new experience, and it's like, it's the most realistic game we've ever made to this point. You should be able to have new ways to interact with it. And the third thing is, if they're thinking in terms of getting new audiences, the best way to get new audience members is to make them forget that they're playing a quote-unquote hardcore RPG.
So
that's true.
Snowboarding.
So, what I've been trying to interject here is, ever since Final Fantasy IV, Square was really pushing Final Fantasy away from the traditional turn-based RPG. Mm-hmm. They introduced the active time battle system. And then in Final Fantasy V, you started to have these events like the Battle on the Bridge where you're like fighting across a bridge, or you have to escape from like the Library of Karnak before it explodes, and so on and so forth. And then in Final Fantasy VI, you have the Moogle strategy game at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And then that becomes like the defense against Kefka. And then you have like the train track thing, and you have the Serpent Trench.
Yep.
So you start getting all these things that are breaking up. You have the Colosseum, just breaking up the sort of standard, rubric of RPG of like town, battle, dungeon. And so this was the technology was there for them to really just kind of go wild with this and really break up some of the paradigms of game design and throw other things into Final Fantasy somewhat seamlessly.
And right before you get to Junon, I think, you find this little settlement that's like, oh, Shinra keeps attacking us and we need your help.
Fort Condor.
Fort Condor. And so then you are like, okay, I'll help you. And then it's like a tower defense game and it's really bad and it's really, really confusing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like, okay, pick units. There's going to be this sort of enemy, so you're going to want to pick these kind of units. And you like spend all of your guild doing it and you lose and you get like, and it's
and
like,
you have to go back. You have to go back regularly and defend Fort Condor, or else like you lose points or something in the overall strategy, like the the campaign.
Yeah,
it's kind of a weird thing that's thrown in. It's not any fun, but it is there. And it definitely descends from the like the Moogle and Kefka defense sequences in Final Fantasy.
Yeah, for
VI.
Sure, for sure. Yep.
Except worse, way worse.
Except much, much worse.
Well, yeah, you're not using like your characters in that case. You're using just like little generic soldiers that you buy.
Right.
So
yeah.
It kind of takes you away from what made the defense sequences in VI so interesting and appealing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, not everything that they tried here necessarily worked.
What was Mog House, though?
Mog House was a little storybook.
Were they trolling you?
No, it was great. It was just like this cute little thing you could watch. And if you listened to a sound cue and pressed a button, then you would get some points or some gil or something. It was just a goofy little silly thing that they threw in there. And I really like Mog House. It's the same story every single time. There's no variety to it. You just like press the button at the same time every time. Mm-hmm. But it's cute that they added that.
I remember doing – I remember playing a lot of Mog House back in the day probably because I think you could get something good for doing Mog House. But I Well, you could, I've forgotten
you,
what that
it
is.
It was really easy to farm points for the Golden Saucer. Much easier than, like, you know, you had the...
That must have been it.
Yeah, you had, like, the roller coaster minigame and stuff. And yep. I found that really hard. So, you know, Mog House was, like, a way to just kind of, like, chill out, get some easy points. You just wait for the little Moogle sounds and press the buttons and you're good.
Well, if you think about the Golden Saucer as a way to kind of ground things in a weird way, it's like a futuristic game center slash amusement park. And
yeah.
People could... totally identify with that and be like, wow, what a cool place to just hang out in, which you could do.
When was Tokyo Disney built?
Ooh. Was it
fairly new at the time that this game came out?
I don't think so. No? I think it was
that the 80s?
I think it was the 80s.
That would make sense because that was when the economy was bumping.
Yep.
Well, never mind then. It was a fun thought, but no.
83.
Okay. Well, that was a dead end.
Well, it was the same year as Nintendo's Mario Brothers in the arcade.
Wow. So, well, there you go. That's something. There's some connection
surely,
there.
Yeah.
There are no Mario Brothers mini games in Final Fantasy VII, but it is interesting. I remember reading at the time that Namco was so impressed with the mini games in Final Fantasy VII that they were like, "Square, we should partner up. We should do some stuff." And so that's where Urgeist came from.
Huh.
The sort of arena fighter that had like some bonus characters from Final Fantasy VII in the arcade, and then when it came to PlayStation, they were like, have all the Final Fantasy characters here. You can play as Reeve. Remember Reeve, who did nothing in the game except control Ketchi from a dark room someplace? Yeah, you can be him now.
Mm-hmm. The Golden Saucer is when Ketchi shows up.
Yep. Well, I mean, Urgeist has nothing to do with the Golden Saucer. It's just a Gold Saucer. It's just there. But actually, that just reminded me, like, there is a point at which Ketchi dies.
Yeah.
And then comes back. Well, you don't have a choice. He just comes right back. He's like, hey, guys.
Heroic sacrifice. I'm back.
I'm trying to remember. Does that happen before or after Aeris dies? It's before, right?
I think before,
around the time.
It's in the Temple of the Ancients.
Yeah.
It's the Temple of the Ancients, but it's before Aeris dies. So I kind of feel like they're sort of setting you up again to like think, well, I'm going to bring back Aeris because Ketchi came back. But
is that before you know what Ketchi Avian is, right?
Well, I mean, you know that he's a robot or something, or like a stuffed animal.
I like how dumb the party is. They don't even question this Moogle, like cat Moogle thing that's following them around.
He shows up at an amusement park. He's like, I'm going to join your party. I'm going to kill monsters with you. I'm going to travel around the world with you as you hunt a homicidal maniac. It's why not?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm so surprised that this turned out to be a Shinra agent. Were you surprised? I was surprised.
Yeah, it's
Moogle suit was so cute.
So some of the writing you definitely had just kind of have to go, all right.
Sure, yeah.
Well, it was a bad sub-arc of basically an anime, which is what Final Fantasy VII is.
Pretty much.
I mean, at this point, after you get out of Midgar, Final Fantasy VII becomes essentially an anthology of stories. I mean, you have Cid with his little arc about launching the rocket, and you have Barrett going back to his hometown, and you've got figuring out what the heck is going on in Nibelheim and the flashbacks. So.
Well, it's interesting because – I'm sorry. Did you want to
say – I was going to say it's like Final Fantasy VI in that each character has their own like quest later in the game you can do optionally.
Utai.
But the interesting thing is that these all happen after you lose Aeris and after you lose Cloud. Like, you lose both of the main characters of the game in pretty rapid succession. You don't lose Cloud permanently, but he disappears for a long time. And when you do find him, he's, like, sitting there talking about how Xenogears is coming. He's like, go buy the game next year.
Xenogears.
So, like, he's basically out of the party for a while. And Cid runs around, you know, looking very constipated and becomes kind of the de facto leader. And so it kind of breaks out and... It's almost like a reverse of Dragon Quest IV, where you have like all the the side character stories, and they come together and join the hero. Now all of a sudden, like, you lose the hero, so you see what the side character stories are, and Does Red 13 have a character arc to speak of? He has to, like, fight some weird monsters or something.
His character arc is when you go back to his hometown and you learn about the nature of the life stream and all that.
Yeah.
And then he has bad feelings about his dad, but he finds out that his dad, I guess, defeated a lot of enemies and then turned to stone, and Red 13 howls.
Yeah, that's right. But yeah, definitely Cid has more of an arc. Barrett has an arc where he goes back to Corel and has to deal with
he goes back to West Virginia.
Oh, yeah.
He the coal mining town.
He uses WordPerfect.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making some Corel jokes, everybody.
No, that's good.
And then the train can either be stopped or will just crash through Corel. Like, that's one of the things too, that you can influence.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
That was always one of my favorite and also most stressful minigames.
I mean, is it really a game when there are so many lives on the line, Kat?
Everything is a game to me.
Oh, okay. So one of the big kind of bonus features in Final Fantasy VII are the weapons. And, you know, that's something that kind of started in Final Fantasy IV, again, where you had some of the, like, these bonus super bosses, Ogopogo and something else in the final
crystal
moon dungeon.
Dragon or
yeah, there was, like, there were a couple of dungeon or dragons in the final dungeon who were guarding super weapons, and you could beat them. And they were tough, but nothing out of the ordinary. But then Final Fantasy V, you had Omega and you had Shinryu. And both of those were, like, super hard, and you had to have very definite strategies to be able to beat them. You had to really understand the battle system. And 6 had – it didn't really have bosses along those lines.
It had stuff like Doomgaze.
Yeah, it had, like, the roaming bosses that you mm-hmm. could fight, you know, consistently around the world, and his health would eventually be whittled down. And it did have some dragons in the Advance remake that they dummied out in the release, like the Kaiser dragon that they dummied out in the initial retail release.
There were
release.
Like 7 dragons to fight in FF6 mm-hmm. and like going around and finding them.
Right. But I mean, that was kind of part of the story. And none of those were especially hard, especially the Earth dragon. You just put on float.
I loved him. Pathetic. He was my favorite dragon.
He was fighting on the opera stage.
He was hanging out on the opera stage for no reason.
He had some class.
Actually, I think he was Dirt Dragon in the original localization because Earth was one character too long.
Dirt Dragon. Sounds like a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, right? Dirt Devil. Forget that. This is the Dirt Dragon. But in Final Fantasy VII, you had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things called weapons. They were just called weapons, and mm-hmm. they were all named after different stones. And I think in the Japanese version, there were only 2 that you could fight. But then they added 3 more for the US version. One of them you only saw in an FMV in the Japanese version. Mm. And I think fans were like, there's like this weapon out there walking around, and I can't kill it. What's up with that? So they added that in and then added a couple more in. And so they added some new items that you could collect. One of them is underwater. And in order to be able to fight it, you have to get the underwater materia that lets you breathe for 20 minutes underwater, which creates a hard limit on how long this battle takes. And you would think, oh, 20 minutes, sure, whatever. But let's not forget that the timer is running during summonses. So anytime you cast a spell or the bad guy casts a spell or you use a summon, that's still counting against your time. So all of a sudden, like this, these fancy spell effects that you have, that's working against you. And 20 minutes turns out not to be long enough to easily defeat this, you know, level 99 super weapon that's roaming the undersea areas of the world.
The Ruby and Emerald weapon were cool because they really gave you a true reason to do everything. And there was so much to do in this game. I mean, breeding chocobos, getting the Knights of the Round materia, getting all the materia you needed from the Colosseum, and then your reward was that you got to beat these uber hard bosses who you basically had to have a very special defined strategy mm-hmm. to take out, or they would just annihilate mm-hmm. you, especially Ruby Weapon. Mm-hmm.
Yep, and I've never beaten any of them.
Same here. Either. I don't have the patience mm-hmm. for that. Yeah.
I think I beat Emerald Weapon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I mean, Ultimate Weapon you have to beat because it's part of the story, and that's how you get Cloud's Ultimate Weapon, mm-hmm. kind of like Atmo Weapon. I think it's the same thing. Just with different
You fight him on the beach, right?
Something like that.
I always thought he was a bit of a
whim. Is that the one that goes after Junon and like takes out the cannon?
Yes.
Okay.
And then there's also Sapphire Weapon mm-hmm. that goes after Midgar, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
Yeah.
And then there's Emerald, Ruby, and Diamond.
And there, the one under the water.
Right.
Yeah.
And so all of these are like out there, you can see them. They're like they're the only enemies you can see roaming the world map, and they'll just kind of hang out there. But if you get up close to them, then you'll die unless you're really prepared for it. So it's one of those optional things you can do. Also optional, I mentioned Yuffie and Vincent. You don't have to add them to your party. In fact, the entire premise of Dirge of Cerberus, the spinoff game, is that because they were optional characters in Final Fantasy VII, they weren't programmed or they weren't rendered for the ending FMVs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And people were like, hey, Vincent and Yuffie were in my party when I beat Sephiroth and Genova. How come they're not in the ending? It's just like the other characters. So Dirge of Cerberus basically exists to explain the fact that, oh, yeah, immediately after you killed Sephiroth,
oh my God,
they went off on a secret mission and were doing some other stuff, you know, while you were trying to escape the Northern Crater or whatever. That's interesting. But each of them has like their own completely optional area attached to them. Yuffie is from the town of
Wutai.
And you don't have to go there. You don't have to get her in your party. You can
Everybody
just ignore her
like,
when she ambushes you.
This is so cool when, like, the fact that the Wutai area was completely separate, its own little arc.
When she ambushes you and, like, steals all your materia, what can you do to not get her in your party at that point? You can just go
run away?
She doesn't steal your materia until you go to Wutai.
Oh, okay.
That's true.
You fight her in the woods, and eventually you can kind of recruit her sort of like Gao in Final Fantasy VI.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, when you go to Wutai, then she steals all your materia, and it creates this fun little like self-contained mini quest because you really can't leave Wutai once all your materia is stolen.
Right.
So you're kind of stuck there doing, you know, very, very little combat because you're reduced down to, you know, the bare bones of what your party can do, which is basically nothing except hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess use items. So you kind of do this quest chasing her around town, and then the Turks show up, and it's sort of like this little lighthearted comedy. It's like the throwaway filler episode of an anime.
Are the Turks on vacation
in that
town?
No, I think they're on vacation in
the beach town.
Yeah, Costa del Sol. And
the Turks.
I don't know exactly what they're doing in Wutai, but they didn't expect to see the party, even though Ketchi is in your party. Anyway.
I mean, Reeve,
but yeah, like,
he's a good executive.
Right. Wutai is basically the equivalent of Rurouni Kenshin's circus episode. Like, it doesn't really have a place
it's
in the overall
arc.
Narrative. Yeah, but it's there, and it's a fun thing you can do extra. And, you know, it lets you have Yuffie in your party, and I think you get a better weapon or materia for it or something.
Plus, it fills in the gaps because it tells you more about the kind of the history of the world, and you find out that like Wutai was at war with Shinra.
Yeah, like this globe crushing superpower industry that owns a city that is like
defeated,
the size of New York City,
and it was defeated and turned into what, a tourist trap?
I guess so. Yeah. Like you wouldn't think Wutai would really stand up too well to all that, but I guess that's you know, the Yamato spirit for you. And then Vincent is in, again, sort of a self-contained area that's pretty much optional. Like, I think you have to go to the haunted house that he's in, but you don't have to do all the quests in there. But if you do, then you find out a lot of backstory about Cloud and Zack and the Soldier Project and Mako and everything like that. And if you can figure out the weird safe cracking combo, you can get Vincent to join your party, and he's just like hanging out in a coffin. he's actually much more like Alucard than Sephiroth is, despite appearances.
There's two spooky boys in this game.
Yep, everyone's so spooky.
He's dead.
He has like claws, and he turns into a werewolf. He can also turn into the devil, but they didn't want to have the word Satan in the game, so his superpower is not Satan Slam, it's Stan Slam. I always wondered, who is Stan? what is happening here? And then later I realized, oh, it's Satan. Okay. I think I read that somewhere online, and I was like, well, that makes a lot more sense. Like,
Stan Slam.
You know, what happened to Ollie? Oh, my God. Stan slammed him.
It's my understanding that there was actually supposed to be a lot more with Vincent. There was supposed to be an entire series of quests where you unlock his powers, but that never came into fruition, and that is one reason why I guess he's a fairly weak character compared to everybody else.
Hmm.
Yeah.
But
so.
He's goth and has a gun, so that's cool.
Yeah.
And dead.
He's also dead, yes.
He was experimented upon by Hojo, and I guess he killed him and brought him back to life. I don't know.
Yeah, but if you do that mini quest, then you see like the flashback where you get the story about what the deal is with Cloud and with Zack. Like, that is really important to understanding who Cloud is and what's up there, and it's totally optional. It's kind of like hidden. And then that's basically the entire basis of Crisis Core is, you know, basically leading up to that escape from, what the hell town is that? Nibelheim?
Mm-hmm.
Nibelheim? Yeah. All right.
Optional.
Speaking of optional, how about those chocobo races? Just racing over and over, over and over, over and over to get that gold chocobo.
Did you guys ever do the gold chocobo breeding?
I did.
Yeah, I had to get Knights of Round because I needed that super powerful spell. And like I said, once I used it, I was like, this is it. I am never using this spell again. This took like 45 minutes just to cast this spell, and I am now like a year older. Like my life is that much closer to ending.
But it looked cool.
What year is it? Yeah, like it kind of looked cool, but it didn't do that much damage. Like considering how long it took, I was like, well, I could have delivered a whole lot more damage just using like normal spell effects in this amount of time.
The chocobo breeding wasn't exactly what you would call fun. It's a little like raising Pokemon, but the fact that it was in there just contributed to Final Fantasy VII's overall scope, and I remember being so impressed that it even had this kind of side quest. It felt like the gateway to you are truly a master of Final Fantasy VII if you are actually raising chocobos. Like, you're really – you know what it's all about. It's kind of a confusing minigame. It doesn't really give you a lot of direction. It's another, like, strategy guide fodder kind of thing. Yeah.
But to your point that, you know, I think it was you, Kat, who said that these minigames in Final Fantasy VII seemed like, you know, proof of concept for real releases.
That was Bob, but yeah.
Okay, Bob. There was a game, Chocobo Racing, that came out a couple of years later on PS1. That was Squall's actual first appearance on any game. And I really feel like they said, okay, what if we did this but made it more fun? Mm. Not a lot more fun, just a little more fun. And so you got, you know, Chocobo Racing as a full release.
And they never really did anything as crazy and expansive as Final Fantasy VII again. Like, when they went to VIII, it was much more focused. They were like, no, you're just doing the card game this time around.
Well, there's, like, cinematic events, but they are tied into the story. Like, the clash of the gardens and that sort of thing. Like, that's crazy. It's, like, this real-time combat and you know, you're doing all kinds of stuff there. But it's very sort of cinematic and constrained and very much in service of the story.
I think that was the appeal of a game like Final Fantasy VII and VIII and IX was that when you were going around this world and there was so much to do at any given time, it felt like you were living in that world. And it felt like a real live kind of world. Like it was basically an open world game.
Yeah, I mean, it was. Like a Rockstar game. You kind of get that stuff in open world games now where it's just like, oh, go do some other stuff. Like, you know, Skyrim, I'll never see the I made it to like the second leg of the main quest of that in 120 hours of playing. I don't care about the stupid dragons like Sovngarde, whatever. Just like, you know, let me run around and hang out with the guys who have bees and like make mead for them. That's neat. I like that. I'm going to go steal like everything and every keep I can find. That's cool. That's fun.
Yeah, the mini games in the Golden Saucer are the equivalent of sitting down and playing poker for 2 hours in Red Dead Redemption 2.
I'm going to take your word on that one. I haven't played that yet. Or ever. We've kind of talked about summons a little bit, but this is sort of the point at which summons became a thing in Final Fantasy. Like you always had evokers and summoners, but it was just like, you know, that was kind of like a higher level spell. It cost more, but it did more damage. But here, summons became a thing unto their own right. And it's interesting because this is the first Final Fantasy in which the summons aren't really tied to anything narrative. You know, in previous Final Fantasies, it was very much about like, well, let's go befriend Ramu or, you know, let's win Bahamut's favor or something like that. But here's just like, well, I was walking through a cave of ice and I found a rock that lets me summon a robot dragon from space. And, you know, you have I'm not exaggerating.
No. I mean, it's true. Yes.
You know, you have quests tied to some of the higher level ones, like the Knights of Round materia that you have to get the gold chocobo to be able to access. But there's no real story explanation for why these rocks allow you to summon a space robot dragon from space or whatever.
they refined it a lot more in 8, where they tied in the Guardian forces much more closely to the story. A lot of the Guardian forces are very specific quests in 8. And
yeah,
I think
they're creatures that you talk to and can summon.
Yeah, so that was something I think that they learned from Final Fantasy VII, was like, okay, the summons are extremely popular, but they weren't extremely well integrated into the actual game. So let's really make a push for that in 8.
But I mean,
well, also because again, they were going to be using these amazing polygonal effects on these summons, cool camera angles. They wanted you to see these things.
They were
probably
the selling
point. I mean, a lot of people didn't really do a lot of summoning in Final Fantasy V and VI, especially because, like, you know, you didn't really necessarily
have a summoner.
VI,
I almost never used summons. You know, the first time I played,
no, I didn't even know they were an option. The first time I played Final Fantasy,
I stumbled into it and was
they're
like,
kind of buried.
Huh,
yeah,
that's kind of weird.
Yeah,
but whatever. It's expensive.
Who
I don't care.
It is expensive. Yeah.
Who can use summons in 6?
Everybody.
Oh,
if,
right,
you
okay.
if you have a materia equipped, you can summon the you know, the Esper associated with that materia.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I did not know that for a long time. Yeah, yep.
But the summons were a nice cheat because they could take all the polygons off the screen except for the summon.
Yeah.
And, we're forgetting that also the screen is smaller. There's, like, less real estate on the screen.
Right.
So they can do a lot in that space with the polygons they're
right.
spending.
And also, there's no need for, like, you know, keeping track of AI commands and things like that, because for that 30 to 1,000 seconds, you basically have the computer just, you know, playing out a scripted event, and
yep.
it doesn't have to take any input. So they were really just like, what can we do with the PlayStation hardware? So they are,
and that is
they are
really,
a wonder to behold.
I remember, yeah, coming out of Final Fantasy VII, probably when I wrote my review of it for my fanzine, and talking about, like, the summon animations and just how cool it was to watch them. Like, that was really what made a big impression on me coming out of that game.
Mm-hmm. They were the selling point, and I mean, there's a reason they were front and center on the demo disc
yeah.
back when it came out. It was just
oh yeah, right.
And there were
the demo
yeah,
disc
there were
and
two
were in,
different
like,
summons as
Midgar,
depending on which demo it was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's Leviathan, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was
and
like
also
the big
Bahamut.
Showcase.
And
yeah.
the summons did more to separate the PlayStation from the N64 than almost anything, because you looked at those summons and you just thought, this can't be done in the N64.
But, you know, the ironic thing is that you probably could have done those summons on N64 way more easily than FMV.
Right.
Like, these were just polygons. The N64 could do that, but it didn't have the storage space to effectively do FMV as Resident Evil demonstrated.
Yeah.
Or Resident Evil 2.
But they felt so big and so epic, and they defined, like, this is what CD storage space can give you. This.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I think that maybe that's the impression you got playing it, or, you know, from the magazines or whatever at the time. But I don't think the summons had much of anything to do with the space,
right.
the storage space of CD-ROM. I mean, they were built out of polygons that were defined by a few vectors, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so it's really about, like...
Yeah, it's more like, here's the horsepower of the PlayStation. And also, just here is this company, Squaresoft, are daring to present this cinematic experience where you least expect it. RPG battles are boring, right? You're just taking turns and choosing menus. But wait, wait. There is Hades cackling over a cauldron, turning your bad guys into, like, damned souls or something. Can you do that on any other game? No.
No.
Only with Square.
Well, it's a good magic trick then, because the most impressive element of the entire game is actually fairly not less hardware intensive than it actually appears.
Right.
Well, I think it's hardware intensive. It's just not storage, you know. Mm. It's not storage hungry.
Right.
I think that's the point. But I mean it was definitely
hardware intensive for sure.
Like, it was making use of all the PlayStation effects, transparencies and, like, you know, whatever the hell else it could do, like motion blur and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it probably would have been easier to do it on the Nintendo 64. It's just that they could have only had, like, one of them.
You wouldn't have had load time on
N64.
Right. It still looked cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they still look kind of cool today, in fact.
Yeah.
Some of them are really cool. I mean, some of them are, yeah. Like, you play it on an emulator or something where it's cleaning up the polygons and making things crisper and nicer textures. And, yeah, they still are quite impressive. There's great cinematography to them. And, you know, even something as simple as Shiva showing up and just, like, I guess, you know, throwing icicles at people.
Yeah.
Like, that's still pretty rad. It's like, wow, there's an ice woman throwing sharp icicles at my enemies. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Thanks, Ice Lady.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really pretty design and cinematography to a lot of the parts of the game. Like, I was just playing through Junon again, right? I mean, so many of the little scenes in Junon, you know, they have really great camera angles, you know, that would set Cloud really far back, and then the angle would sort of be in a 45 degree to the street, or like coming up out of there's an airship on the top of the whole thing, and like the pink clouds in the background, and again, sort of like running towards the camera, and they really thought about, the camera angle is arbitrary, so, you know, let's just do every different type of camera angle.
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing was is that I actually abused the top level magic, like Ultima, and the limit breaks a lot more than I did the summons.
Well, they went by a lot faster. They didn't go nearly as long.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the summons could do a lot of damage, but so could the spells and the limit breaks.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, in practical terms, the summons weren't that useful, but they were a way to make Final Fantasy VII stand apart. Mm-hmm. And they also, you know, were a way to kind of say, like, here's a connection to the past. This is Final Fantasy now taking an element that's been here in the series since, you know, Final Fantasy II or Final Fantasy III and basically, like, exploding it into something amazing. Like, you've never seen this before. Yeah, you've summoned Shiva and Ifrit and Ramu before, but not like this. Yeah, you've had, you know, Choco Mog summons before, but not like this. And you've never seen Kajada, whatever the hell that thing is. you can even summon Chupan from Final Fantasy VI under the proper name Typhoon here.
Mm-hmm.
Like the guy who would sneeze you out of battle if you were too cocky in the Colosseum. He's here sneezing your enemies out of battle. It's great.
Weirdly, Final Fantasy XV did kind of the same thing.
How so?
In terms of making the really really elaborate summon animations kind of a big defining moments of the game.
Yeah, I mean this ended up kind of being an albatross around the series' neck because these were so impressive. They, you know, with each iteration they had to one up the previous games.
Because everybody was like, oh, I wonder how the summons are going to be in Final Fantasy VIII. They're going to be probably really good. It's like, crap.
But at the same time, they were like, well. Also, it's kind of boring to just sit there and do this over and over again. So with Final Fantasy VIII, they added, you know, the boost ability.
Yeah, which made it much worse.
Yeah. Like, you'd summon them and, oh, you pressed a button at the wrong time at the very last second, and now your summon does 1/4 damage. Sorry about all the life you just wasted.
Well, there's a reason I don't use the – I didn't use the GFs in FF8.
Mm.
And then by 9, Square said, well, we're not going to let you skip them. But we're going to shorten them dramatically.
Well, no, there is an something you can pick up, I think, where you can just like it if you equip it or something, you can just like skip Guardian animations pretty much. Like they'll appear and then it'll cut basically to the final animation.
That was a 9 and they made it really short.
I remember like the first time you summon them, you'll get the elaborate one. But then
that's what it is.
It'll be shorter. That's what I remembered, yeah.
Yeah, but then you'd occasionally get the elaborate one again just randomly. Mm.
But then 10, I think they finally figured it out. They turned summons into like party members. They were like, you know, if Yuna summoned an enemy, like for one thing, the summon was sort of the core of the quest. They were like, summons are the thing. Like you are on a quest to get more summonses. And so when Yuna would summon an Eidolon, I think is what they called it. Is that what they called it in 10? Whatever they called him, it would like show up in battle and replace
and
other party members.
It.
Yeah, they were like your pals who would kill stuff for you, and you could, you know, integrate them into combat more. So they weren't just one-off animations, but actually like a tactical consideration for battle who you had to, you know, manage and keep healthy and so forth.
Yeah, you could use them to block enemy spells, especially like death spells and that kind of thing. And they were pretty useful in that regard.
So, you know, a lot of things that happened in Final Fantasy VII, it took Square a while to figure out, like, how do we do this perfectly? But it did so much all at once that it's impossible not to look back and be impressed by the audacity of the game. It's just so ambitious. And they put this together in, like, 2 years, which is unthinkable. Like, they can't even make a remake of this game in 2 years or 10 years, for God's sakes. So, yeah, like, they accomplished a lot on brand new hardware with a brand new, like, presentation and gameplay paradigm. It's a huge feat. Like, this game is amazing, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is when Square was truly firing on all cylinders. They weren't the bloated kind of publisher that they are today, that they were still fairly lean and mean. Sakaguchi had been kicked upstairs, but the next round of talent was upcoming, and I mean, and you saw it in the way that they were able to pump out games, really good games mm-hmm. at that. And FF7 was the – well, it was the turning point both for better and for worse.
Yeah, and I mean they really had to scale up as well just because they just needed so many more people to create a Final Fantasy VII. It was just so much more work.
They were in Hawaii at this point too. They had like a branch in Hawaii as well at this
yeah,
point.
Yeah, I think the Hawaii branch did some of the CG. Isn't that the
For 7?
Yeah, wasn't that right?
No, LA? No, it was LA.
LA, okay.
They had,
okay, I knew
Square,
was,
they had established Square in
Sakaguchi
in LA.
Wanted to be in Hawaii.
He's like, he did. Taking and he, a surfboard.
I think he was
surfboard,
there by
surfboard.
Final Fantasy 8. I mean, the huge success of Final Fantasy 7, all the money that came in, like, that's when they established
they were like,
the Hawaii branch, I
Sakaguchi,
believe,
you can go aloha and do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. You made us incredibly wealthy. We are on top of the world now. Yep. Go do it. But that lasted until Spirit
Shouldn't
Spirit.
Have told him that.
Oof. Yeah. Mm. So to kind of wind this down, we should talk about Sephiroth and Genova and what the hell is going on in the ending. Like, is Sephiroth – so you know, all throughout the game, you're chasing Sephiroth, and every time you catch up to him, you have to fight Genova, and it's kind of weird. And then you find out, oh, Sephiroth actually has been frozen in the life stream beneath the planet all this time, and you've just been fighting, like – What have you been fighting? Not the clones.
No,
you've been fighting like chunks of Genova.
Was in the life stream, and he through the life stream, sort of like how when Voldemort died. Because I have to compare everything to Harry Potter. He was still sort of alive and out there and able to manipulate things. So I think what Sephiroth did, maybe J.K. Rowling played Final Fantasy VII before she wrote Harry Potter.
I mean, this idea didn't come from Lord of the Rings at all.
Exactly. So Sephiroth, J.K. Rowling was – I'm getting this all confused now. But it was in the life stream.
So J.K. Rowling was in the life stream?
J.K. Rowling was in the life stream.
Sephiroth was a Slytherin.
And then manipulating – yeah. Sephiroth was manipulating the Genova body to pretend to be Sephiroth. Like Sephiroth was using his brain powers to think and get into the corpse of Genova, and then that Genova took on the appearance of Sephiroth. And so whenever you're fighting that thing, it was Genova pretending to be Sephiroth, but even further behind that curtain, it was Sephiroth controlling Genova, controlling fake Sephiroth.
Yeah.
While Sephiroth was making a new body for himself in a cocoon.
In the northern crater,
exactly.
As one does.
Which, by the way.
As you can see, it is all incredibly simple.
If you ever went into the store near the Square Enix headquarters, mm-hmm. you can see like a life-size version of cocooned Sephiroth.
Oh, really?
Under the floor.
In the floor, yeah, on the ship.
Yeah,
like
it's amazing.
There's like a shopping room where you can buy Advent children figures and stuff. Mm-hmm. And there, if you look down, you're like, oh, Sephiroth's looking at my skirt. I mean, not my skirt. I don't wear skirts, but if I were wearing a skirt, I would
kill
a kilt.
Exactly.
Joke's on him. I wear kilts properly.
The point is that the Sephiroth you see in the game, that is not Sephiroth. That is a clone or a facsimile of Sephiroth.
Yeah. Right. So I guess the first time you fight Sephiroth, when you see him and he kills Eris, it's actually Genova. And that's why, like, whenever you come across him, all of a sudden you have a Genova battle and the cool music starts. And there are three different Genova battles leading up to kind of like the big revelation. There's Genova birth, Genova life, and Genova death. So there's like some sort of cycle going on there that's never really explicitly explained, but that just kind of makes it more intriguing, in my opinion. But yeah, so the like the weird like woman's corpse face body thing you see in the Shinra building is Genova, and then like that's dragging itself around. I don't know.
Is Genova an alien or something?
Yes, Genova was an
calamity
alien.
Calamity from beyond the stars.
Yes. Yep.
So that's kind of what gets down to the whole thing with Eris is that she is one of the, I guess, the last surviving member of the Cetra, which was an ancient race of like spiritually connected people who understood the planet and stuff. And Genova was a calamity that came to Earth or came
basically
to Gaia
it.
And destroyed the Cetra. And when they discovered Genova, they were like, oh, this must be a lost Cetra. When Shinra's scientists discovered her, which was like Hojo and Gast and some other people. And they thought, oh, cool, we found someone nice from the past. But it was actually someone evil.
Mm.
And so they took Genova's genetics, like her DNA and cells and stuff, and infused them into people to try to make super soldiers. And it worked out for Sephiroth, more or less. But then there were a lot
Did
of other
– really?
Well, I Can mean, we he went insane and out. Killed everyone and tried to blow up the planet. But yeah. aside from
but
that –
But once he found – but that was only once he found out, like, what had true. Happened to him and his evil – his origins, and that, like, broke his mind.
I feel like he overreacted.
Just a little bit.
Like, I'd be upset if I found out I was actually, like, a genetic experiment based on aliens. But I don't think I'd try to kill everyone. I'd be like, wow, do I get like Social Security still?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like he kind of went nuts. But, you know, up until that point, he was very successful. But then they had a lot of other experiments that they conducted on people, and they all tended to go horribly wrong. Like, things didn't work out so well with Cloud. It worked out, I guess, with Zach, but that was kind of the exception. So the soldiers were like augmented with Genova cells.
And Hojo's the real villain of the entire, like, overarching villain. All of the events of SF7 are animated by his crazy experiments.
Right. He's kind of the Gendo Ikari of the joint, except he dies horribly midway through.
Well, yeah. Gendo dies horribly later, so it's all synergy.
Well, he dies almost happily. He almost gets to control third impact.
Splat.
Oh, well. We just tried to explain the backstory and the core plot of Final Fantasy VII and failed.
We tried to explain Evangelion yesterday.
Yeah,
in this room.
We also failed. But
the game, the stories are similar. Mm. They're similarly convoluted.
Well, the core plot is Sephiroth, like a clone of Sephiroth, is running around trying to reunify with Genova and summon Meteor to destroy everything. And meanwhile, Aeris is animating the life energy to try and stop it, and she's doing that through Holy. And so it's very kind of environmentally friendly, naturalistic, like the good, the spiritual good fighting the spiritual bad coming from space.
Right. And there was definitely Evangelion influence in Final Fantasy VII. In the Gold Saucer, you can find D-type armor.
Oh.
It's like a trophy in the background.
It's amazing.
It's very small. It's not the right scale, but that's okay. Like, they definitely were making some nods, like some open nods, saying, yeah, like, we really liked Evangelion, and that's okay.
And the weapons, I mean, they're basically angels, but kind of good because they're operating on behalf of the planet.
Yeah, kind
of. The angels in Evangelion are actually, I mean, also kind of part of the planet as well. They're their own race.
Right.
Yeah, so don't try to think about it too much.
But the thing with Meteor and Holy, that's another way that Square was building on the legacy of Final Fantasy, because mm-hmm. those were, you know, spells from previous games. Meteor in particular was a critical spell in Final Fantasy IV. That was what Tella was trying to learn to destroy Golbez. And Holy was a spell that had a kind of rough time in English localizations up until Final Fantasy VII,
because
Nintendo
white
was like,
for a long
"Holy,
time.
No,
Pearl?
It's Pearl, it's Holy, yeah. it's white, it's Fade, mm-hmm. it's not Holy." So we kind of lost that, I think, you know, at the time, but it's become more obvious in hindsight. Like, oh, they're taking these elements from sort of the Final Fantasy lexicon, you know, from the spell lexicon, and they're turning them into these huge critical plot points.
We lost Nuke, though.
We did lose Nuke.
And this was the time that Lifestream and the whole of the planet spirituality became a big thing, especially with Sakaguchi, I feel like. And they started to appear quite a bit in a lot of his works, even Spirits Within, perhaps especially Spirits Within.
Yeah. Like that whole thing was an attempt to kind of wrangle a lot of ideas from Final Fantasy VII. It didn't quite work out, but yeah, it was like one big, long, boring cutscene. finally, let's wrap by talking about the game's legacy. Final Fantasy VII was a big deal. It was a huge selling point. Like, Sony published it in the U.S. rather than Square because I think they recognized this is some hot shit and people are going to want to play this, especially if we don't let them know that it is a turn-based RPG controlled by menus. If we just show them FMVs of, like, you know, one of the main characters being buried in a watery grave, let's give away all the spoilers and the kids are going to love it. And it's true. People were like, this game looks amazing.
It could have been a water birthing class. We wouldn't have known.
I mean, I heard about it through word of mouth. I mean, everybody knew about Final Fantasy VII. And to that point, I had kind of been aware of Final Fantasy through magazines and such, but it broke into the zeitgeist. It was on TV commercials. You had the train coming at you, and it coming to PlayStation felt like a big deal when it ultimately came out.
Yeah, I'd been sort of following the game's rumors and development since Final Fantasy VI came out in the U.S., and I was like, I love Final Fantasy now. I need, you know, the next one. I'm going to get a PlayStation eventually because I got to play Final Fantasy VII. But I didn't really know that much about the game until I was at the I mentioned this in one of the episodes we recorded yesterday, the weird PC gaming shop where I lived, where everyone was kind of like a little weird, but they did import stuff and, you know, turned me on to Evangelion and like, someone there was playing the Japanese version of Final Fantasy VII and was in Wutai. And so they had made it pretty far into the Japanese version of the game. And I saw it in motion and this was like in, you know, February 1997 or something. It was really early on. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. I need to own this game. So I went and found a used copy of Tobal number 1 at a pawn shop because that's how I love to support my developers. And played the demo disc and was like, yes, this is it. This is Final Fantasy, but new and fresh for the PlayStation era. Hot damn.
The last time we talked about Final Fantasy VII, you were kind of positing that it wasn't exactly a turning – it wasn't exactly as big as I was suggesting. You said, well, Gran Turismo outsold it, but it also was a hinge in so many ways because it opened up the floodgates for a lot of JRPGs to come over. It was so popular that even Sony was making a JRPG in Legend of Dragoon. It changed Square itself, for better or worse, and it propelled Final Fantasy from favorite of JRPG fans and a big game to one of the most popular like game franchises, period.
I would say it also helped prime the pump for anime and manga to come to the U.S.
Yes.
I mean, it's not single-handedly responsible. Certainly there were, you know, things being localized before that, but I really feel like that was the point, like an inflection point at which people were, you know, started to become aware of Japanese media and said, I need more of this in my life because it's extremely cool. And so, you know, a couple of years later, you had Toonami and things like that.
It was explicitly Japanese in a way that had not been the case just a couple of years before.
Yeah, and it was probably, and you have that, we mentioned Evangelion, you know, yeah, that was a really huge deal in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's perhaps, I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, it even makes nods to Evangelion, but perhaps that kind of like super weirdness of that story was what inspired Final Fantasy to become super weird.
It's, yeah,
they become kind of
like
a mirror of each other, and then people in the U.S. experience Final Fantasy VII first, and then they start watching Evangelion, and they start looking for things that have that flavor of like weird sci-fi in their stories, and
find it
in anime and manga.
I'm not in any way saying that Final Fantasy VII was single-handedly responsible for bringing all that stuff over, but it definitely was like part of a katamari of awareness that just kind of rolled up in the late 80s or late 90s. And it had a huge impact over here just like it did in Japan. And, you know, Super Smash Bros. Ultimate just came out a few days as of this recording. And you know, a big part of that is being able to play as Cloud. He is a character that stands out among 74 other characters.
So sadly, Square only allowed like 2 songs from Final Fantasy VII in there.
I can't believe that.
The Midgar stage is really good because you have the detailed like vision of the smokestacks in the background and all that, and the summons appear and you can grab the materia and then they do things to the stage like cleave it in half, which is really cool. But you could tell, for whatever reason, Square seemed very protective of how things were going to go with that character. So Cloud isn't nearly as well realized as all the rest of the characters.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that Cloud is not very well realized in anything except Final Fantasy VII.
I don't think there are even any spirits or assist trophies associated with Clouds in Smash Ultimate. Yeah, like Cloud really stands alone in a way that other characters simply don't.
I mean, that's
don't.
Why he's so sad all the time.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about the game's sequels and spinoffs here, but we don't have time, so we'll have to do that some other day.
That could be a whole other episode.
Yeah, I think it should be. One thing that really stands out is that in all the spinoffs and sequels that Square officially produced to Final Fantasy VII, it's like they just totally forgot what Cloud's character arc was in VII. The whole point of VII is that he starts out, you know, trying to be someone he's not, thinking he's someone he's not, goes through a deep existential crisis. Like, his crisis, I would say, is way deeper than Sephiroth's, because Sephiroth is like, oh, my dad and mom are aliens? That's not cool. That's weird. I wish they hadn't done that to me. But Cloud is like, wow, everything in my life is a horrible lie. I've been manipulated and, you know, spent 5 years being tortured and recreated into someone I'm not. That sucks, but, you know, he spends a little time in a wheelchair and then wakes up and he's like, you know what? I got to live my life. Let's go save the planet.
Yeah, it's a deconstruction of the typical anime hero. He starts out as a total badass at the end, and then by the end is, let's mosey.
Yep. You're like, oh, he's actually kind of a dork and he's endearing. And then in, like, in Advent Children, he's just, like, sad again. He's like, it's like he never had that revelation.
Yeah.
And he's still in the wheelchair listening to his voicemails.
He was a sullen badass in Advent Children.
I have a weird comparison to make before we go. I think Cloud is like Buzz Lightyear in that he already had his arc. So now whenever he comes back, it's just like, make him what he was before in some way.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But at no point does he, like, begin to speak Spanish.
True.
So
or
it's
think,
very disappointing.
Think he's, like, in a video game or something.
Right.
Like,
it's just so hard to convey what a revelation Final Fantasy VII was in 1997. Like, we really had not seen a game like this. And the sheer scope of it, but not only that, it's kind of cheesy now, but the psychological elements of – there's an entire sequence devoted to Tifa helping Cloud work through his mental issues and reunite himself and find his true memories.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I found that really boring, but I was also a teenager. And now I look back on that, I'm like, wow, I'm amazed that they had the courage to do that in that particular era. And mm-hmm. it was emblematic of games changing really rapidly from the 16-bit to the 32-bit era.
I kind of feel like that's another Evangelion thing, because that, you know, that's really what we were talking about in the Evangelion episode, like the interiority of the characters and kind of coming to terms with who they are and their losses and their disappointments. Like that was the heart of that story. So, you know, I think Evangelion kind of emboldened Final Fantasy VII's creators, especially the writer Kazushige Nojima, to just like step back and say, let's try a different approach. And you saw that happening in a lot of RPGs, especially from Square around this time, like Xenogears and Chrono Cross and so forth. But I feel like Final Fantasy VII probably was the most earnest attempt at that.
And then the ending, really quickly. I remember at the time it was controversial, but I look back on it now and I'm like, I liked that it had the courage to be ambiguous. You don't really know what happened to the characters. There was a climax. It was an exciting climax. I mean, meteors coming down. Holy is seemingly stopping it. What happened? Did they live? Did they die?
Yeah, I mean, the game leaves it ambiguous. You see a postscript that's 500 years later and Red 13 has some kids and they go and like – march along or not, you know, they trot along the wastelands and end up on a promontory looking over Midgar. And Midgar is a ruin that's been grown over by plants. You're like, wow, did the life stream and Holy save the planet by just killing all humanity? Is that what happened? And
but
it leaves it totally ambiguous.
Well, wait, you hear kids laughing.
You hear
the
children laughing. But is that like ghosts of children? Are they laughing from the life stream? You don't know.
Okay.
Like it's left really ambiguous. And then Advent Children comes along and it's like, oh no, everything's just like it was and everyone's wearing black now and also and everyone's got a disease.
And here's Sephiroth again for some reason, they're flying through the air fighting him.
I feel like that's a whole episode of being angry at bad spinoffs, so we should save it for then.
I've never seen Advent Children.
Oh, you're going to at some point. You're gonna
I want to see it for the show.
Yeah. What year did that come out?
2005?
Yeah.
Is that old?
Yeah.
Holy crap. Yep. All right, well, that is eligible for Retronauts Kids.
Maybe I will do that
when
episode.
When it came out, I bought it on UMD.
Oh, of course.
The perfect way to watch any movie.
Oh,
absolutely.
Oh,
because if you don't enjoy it, you just twist your PSP and it shoots across the room.
Advent Children was the breaking point for me.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
it was
but we'll
for
talk
me
about
too,
that in the spinoff episode.
But then Crisis Core came out, and I was like, oh, this is good.
Okay. Yeah, well, Crisis Core was
Crisis
good.
Core was the only, like, good spinoff mm-hmm. to come out of Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right, well, our next episode guests are here, so we have to break.
We have to end.
We have to break up this episode. So, yeah, everyone, thanks for talking about Final Fantasy VII. This is not the final story in any way, because we have to talk about the crappy spinoffs and the good one. And maybe by the time we record that episode, the remake will be out, but probably not. Let's take our wages here. What year do you think the Final Fantasy VII remake will come out? I'm going to say 2024.
Boy, you're more. I was gonna say PS5 launch game.
I'm gonna say 2023 because it took about took about 5 years for. So okay, Kingdom Hearts 3 was announced before work even really started on it, and it actually kind of pissed off Nomura, and so he decided to basically backburner FF7 remake. From what I'm able to understand, especially after the CyberConnect stuff didn't work out, because mm-hmm. they were like, "Well, CyberConnect is going to do a lot of the work," and then it wasn't working out. So now it's been backburnered. He's been focusing on Kingdom Hearts 3. Kingdom Hearts 3 is finally coming out. And then so if it takes 5 years for him to get Kingdom Hearts 3 out, so focusing solely on that, then perhaps FF7 remake will eventually come out, and it won't be episodic. It will be a full game.
Ooh.
I'm planting my flag in there, and it will be a PS5, Xbox 2, whatever.
PS5, Xbox 2.
Or a Nintendo Switch 2 exclusive.
Ooh, okay.
There you go.
All right, Chris, what do you say?
I still think it'll be PS4. I think it'll be episode. Well, I
that's
mean,
late
be,
PS4.
There will be a PS5 version, right? Yeah. But it'll probably be.
Oh, you're
going to
say it's
going to
be both, like Persona 5 was?
Yeah. Maybe episode 1 at the end of 2020.
You think it's still going to be episodic? Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. I think they said it was going to be, right? So
yeah, they said a lot of things.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They did.
I mean, I think that we're going to see a true reveal at some point. And like everything that's been said to this point, it's just been floating.
Yeah, I guess, you know what? You're right. I mean, they've said so much, and they've changed developers, which is mm-hmm. a bad thing. Yeah, you're right. Maybe it's not episodic anymore. But if it's not episodic anymore, that means it's we're not
he's already musing on more spinoffs.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Well, anyway,
PS5, 2022.
The point is, we don't know, and neither do you, precious listener. And we're sorry about that. But maybe someday we'll be playing a remake of this game. If not, there are lots of ways to play it now. So you know, go play it, shoddy translation and all. It's fine. Anyway, thanks everyone for talking about Final Fantasy VII again. And God, I can't believe there's still more to say about this game, but so it goes. We're wrapping this episode of Retronauts now, so let me tell you that I am Jeremy Parrish, who was kind of hosting this episode, and you can find me on Retronauts podcasts talking about video games at retronauts.com and on iTunes and so on and so forth. You can also find me personally as GameSpite on Twitter. Holy cow. Bob, what about you?
Hey, it's Bob Mackey. I'm on Twitter as Bob Servo. I have two other podcasts, Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. You can find those by looking them up on the internet or in your podcast machine. And I also have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. We do a lot of exclusive stuff there at the $5 level. And by the time you hear this, we'll be doing a brand new mini-series exclusive only to patrons. It might be King of the Hill. It might be Mission Hill. It might be Venture Brothers. Who knows? We'll be doing it at this moment in time probably. So yeah, check it out at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. Thank you.
I'm Kat Bailey, editor-in-chief of USG, and by the time you hear this, there should be a whole lot of PAX East stuff going on, and our top 25 RPG countdown on Acts of the Blood God, which you should subscribe to. It's on Spotify, iTunes, and all of that, should be done.
Is Final Fantasy VII number one?
No, Final Fantasy VII is not on that list.
Prep your angry – whoa.
Yeah.
Prep your extremely angry letters.
There are some Square games, and we – actually, Final Fantasy V is in that top 25.
Oh, whew. Thank goodness.
Chris is breathing a sigh of relief.
I really am. Final Fantasy V is so unrecognized. But I'm glad it'll be in your list.
Yes, it's on the list. We've already done that. So
Right. Did you have Jeremy rank all the Final Fantasies?
Oh, man, we should do that.
No, that was Polygon. I did that with Polygon already.
Right.
Well, we're just going to have to do our counter list at some point, because I feel like we've been doing dueling lists with Polygon for a while now.
I'll rank the shit out of Final Fantasy.
At the point of this podcast, I will be done doing Polygon stuff.
Oh.
So, because of my new day job. So there you go. Anyway, Chris, tell us about your day job.
Oh, my day job is features editor at Kotaku, which is a video game website you may or may not have heard of. And occasionally, I don't edit features. Occasionally, I write things on Kotaku, and so you can come and read those things. With this episode, will be coming out sometime in the middle of the year 2019, so I really can't say much about what I've written recently. Just know that I'm probably still doing that job when you listen to this.
Fingers crossed.
Yep. And finally, Retronauts itself is supported through Patreon, much like Bob's other ventures. You can find that campaign at patreon.com/retronauts, and $3 a month gets you early access to episodes such as this, and also gets you episodes in a higher bit rate so they sound better and you can hear our throaty noises and weird lip smacking and stuff in high definition. I know you love that.
I edit those out. Come on.
And there are no advertisements. So that's a good deal. $3 a month, patreon.com/retronauts. Anyway, that's enough pimping. It is time for us to go ahead and do other things. So we'll be back in like a week or so, actually a few more days, with another episode, and you can look forward to it.